I want to welcome everyone to the Second Court of Appeals for our 2:30 argument. It's our second and final case being argued today, so we're glad to have you. We're glad to be back in person, obviously. Let me introduce the panel before we get started, because I understand counsel have checked in and given the clerk the times that they want. To my left is Justice Mike Wallach. To my right is Justice Dana Womack, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So unless there are any questions, housekeeping matters, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
Court will now call Newstream Hotels and Resorts, LLC, and Newstream's Commercials, LLC, versus J.C. Abdu, et al. May this court, Mr. Carlisle Vaughn, will argue for the appellant. Mr. Andrew Cox will argue for the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, good afternoon, your honors. We're here today asking that the court reverse Judge Johnson's second order denying the motion to dismiss filed by appellants. I must have forgotten, but it came to my attention recently in preparation for today that he had signed the second order, which I believe amended the first order. The first order was a complete denial of the motion to dismiss. And then there was a second order signed a few days later that specifically stated that the motion was being denied as to the first step. So we're asking that the court reverse that order as to the first step, remand the case back to Judge Johnson and Denton to hear the second and third step. With that said, Your Honor, I think it's important to step back a little bit from this case and understand that I know the court has a heavy docket of TCPA motions and rulings. I know the court less than 30 days ago came out with a new TCPA case. And this is a case that we have here that is unique. It's not something that you normally see. And it's unique in the sense of what we have is causes of action for indemnifications of legal fees, not through the traditional vehicle of a declaratory relief judgment, where we say, you say you're entitled to indemnification, we say we're not, we ask that the court at the conclusion of the trial make a determination of one way or the other. We have a preemptive claim that says your indemnification is wrongful and a breach of contract, the partnership agreement between the parties, as well as a breach of fiduciary duty. So this isn't some situation where the court is being asked to expand the TCPA or read into the statute a very broad application. Because of the narrow focus of the particular causes of action here, I believe that this is a unique case. It's a rare case. It's frankly nothing I've ever seen before in my 15 years. I haven't seen a breach of contract for indemnification. I've always seen it by way of a declaratory judgment. And with that said, I think it would be most helpful for the court in my limited time here to focus on two communications made the basis of the motion to dismiss. The first one is the July email, my email, where I notified opposing counsel that there was a capital call being done for purposes of raising money because indemnification payments are being made. And what we see in response to that email is the amended petition approximately 30 days later, incorporating the new essential facts of wrongful indemnification. And that communication, as I understand the response brief, is conceded as a protected communication. And it's my understanding from the response brief that our motion was timely filed. So what we have is a protected communication alleging new essential facts that is spawned by, as the cases say, or the result of my email communication. And we know not only is it in the pleading, it's also in the evidence presented by the appellees. They purport to have clear and specific evidence of damages through affidavits where each of them say, basically verbatim, I was notified of these indemnity payments. These indemnity payments are damaging to me because they may or may not cause me to lose my capital investment. and therefore they're wrongful, among other reasons.
What their pleading seems to say is that they're suing for breach of contract and unlawful payments, not because of a communication about breach of contract or unlawful payments. So what's the connection between the communication and the pleading?
If you look at the summary, the response, the evidence that's presented, that's where you see the connection. I understand the pleading is a wrongful withdrawal. And as we've pointed out, there was nothing wrongful about the withdrawal. It was the actual payment of the expenses that's at issue. I mean, it forms the basis of their damage model. It forms the basis of the affidavits. That is the crux of what we're talking about. And we've addressed this in the reply brief. Parties aren't allowed to plead around the TCPA protection by simply saying it's the act underlying the communication that forms the basis of the cause of action. I use the example of, well, every defamation case will now be when the send button is hit. It's not the actual communication, because that would trigger the TCPA. What we have is the underlying communication. It was the wrongful publishing, the wrongful act of hitting the send button. So that's what we're faced with. I understand the pleading says a wrongful withdrawal, but then when challenged, we're presented with sworn testimony that says, once notified by this email, we decide that it's not in the best interest of the group, it wasn't done in good faith, and we didn't vote to permit these payments. And because of all of that, the totality of that, we then have been damaged, because these payments that are going to be paid for the indemnification, as they say, as they speculate, likely lead to less return of our investment. So trying to square all of that together, I think the only conclusion that can be drawn is artful pleading, attempting to plead outside the scope of the TCPA, doesn't supersede the actual evidence that is brought forward. The evidence is not that withdrawing it was wrongful. I mean, the general partner could have withdrew it and not paid it, and then it's not a wrongful withdrawal. It's the actual payment of the expenses and the fees. So, Your Honor, I hope that answers your question. That's how I view this. That's how I think the court has to view it, because otherwise, again, we're left with the situation where everybody knows how the TCP works. Everybody knows it has to be focused on a communication. I can manufacture causes of action based on actions that underpin the communication and then say, I'm not suing for a communication. Yes, my damage model is based on that communication, but I'm not suing on that communication. I'm suing on the underlying conduct, and the case law is clear that the TCPA doesn't apply to conduct.
All right, go ahead.
So, Your Honor, following up with that, the second point is the checks. The second communication is the checks. The case law is clear that a communication can be in oral form or in written form. We have the checks. And that is the factual predicate, in my opinion, for this lawsuit. Again, the checks, the monies, are the damage. Their entire damage model is based on this $25,000 approximately that has been paid, has been wrongfully paid. It should not have been paid. And why should it have not have been paid? Because it wasn't in the best interest of the group. It wasn't done in good faith. And there was no vote by the members to permit this payment. So those two communications, the check, which, and there's persuasive authority out there, I know that the court has cited just last month, about the main ingredient or a fundamental part of the cause of action. I mean, that's, at the end of the day, that claim boils down to payment should not have been made because it was wrongful, allegedly, and because of that wrongful payment, I have been damaged in the amount of the check amount. So that's, I believe, the based on nexus that we have. We have my email communication with the nexus being formed by in response to, because That claim was made in response to my email. They responded to my email to the notification that indemnification payments were being made by filing the amended petition with these new causes of action. And then, as again, the respondents concede in their brief, this was a timely motion to dismiss. And as I pointed out in the reply brief, it could only be timely if it alleged new essential facts which would trigger that 60-day window. So the response to my email is the first amended petition, happens less than 30 days. They specifically rely on that each of the investors, say in basic form, once notified of this communication, once notified of these indemnity payments, I then realize, hey, I've been damaged. So that is the in response to connection that exists for that communication. That's the easiest example there. And then the check is the based on, because again, what they're complaining about at the end of the day is not the withdrawal, it's the actual payment of the litigation costs, payment of the expenses. It forms their damage model. It forms everything that supports their claim. It's not, again, the withdrawal. I mentioned in the reply brief, it's not from the wrong institution. It's not that it was done without the proper controls from the financial institution. It was, you're not entitled to indemnification.
So if you'd never written them a letter and they just found out about it someday and filed suit, that would be different?
Well, I think it would be, the in response to would be out the window. I think the based on would still be there because it's still the right to petition, still the exercise of the right to petition through the check. Yes, I think they find out through a third party, not through somebody like us, in response to out of the window because it's not being done in response to our exercise of the right to petition. But the check issue is still there. What they're trying to do at the end of the day, and this is why I believe they didn't bring a declaratory.
How does writing a check constitute a right to petition?
The case law is clear that a check constitutes a communication, and the communication is in or pertaining to the judicial proceeding. These are litigation fees and expenses in connection with this lawsuit. I mean, if
so, whoever wins the race to the courthouse, the other side's going to face a TCPA claim, a defense?
And again, that's why I said we have to step back, not on a traditional declaratory judgment, because it plays out this way, in my opinion, on a traditional declaratory judgment. I sue you for indemnification. I learn of the indemnification. I file a lawsuit for declaratory judgment. TCPA comes. The clear specific evidence is you say you're entitled to it. I say you're not. That's all I have to prove. I don't have to prove whether it's wrongful. I only have to prove that it's in controversy. And that's, frankly, what I anticipated vis-a-vis the email. I did not anticipate an sort of preemptive claim that says, forget whether it's wrongful or court determination down the road, as traditionally done. This has caused us damage. It's caused us damage in the fact that we may or may not be entitled to or receiving a fair amount or a full amount of our
So through self-help, you won the race to the courthouse and they're stuck with a TCPA situation?
Sorry, I don't understand.
So if you preemptively claim your right to indemnity, if that occurs,
sure,
then any claim after that's going to be subject to a TCPA claim.
So if I file a counterclaim for declaratory relief for a TCPA, can they file it?
So once, in other words, if the party who preemptively takes their indemnification.
Yes.
Okay. They won the race to the courthouse then through self-help, correct?
Well, I don't know if it's a race to the courthouse or self-help. It's just an exercise of the contractual rights that have been bargained for between the parties. Nobody's saying you can't challenge that contractual right, but you have to do it.
But if you're claiming that act is part of the petition for redress,
yes,
then a counterclaim subject to that by your argument would be in response to that and therefore subject to the TCPA.
Depending on whether it is in fact in response to it, yes. Yes, I mean, and this is what I argued in the reply brief. I mean, there's this gray area of what's the difference between based on and in response to, right? So I don't think you can get around the fact that somebody files something in response to the right to petition or the right of free speech. I mean, that's what the statute is there for. That's what it protects. If I exercise my contractual right to indemnification in connection with a lawsuit, again, that you filed against me, what are my options? I mean, this is, I believe, the purpose of the TCPA, to stop this type of silencing, this type of chilling, where under this scenario, it's not, if I don't have a race to the courthouse, I don't get to exercise my right to petition by the indemnification rights, because it's not only indemnification of a judgment or a settlement, it's also an advancement of fees. So if I'm unable to exercise the right to take advanced fees, even though bargained for among the parties, for fear that the TCPA might, you know, kind of muddy the waters because I ran to the courthouse and did it first or preemptively exercised it. I mean, that's precisely the point. I should be able
to. Thank you, Mr. Brown. Your time's up.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. The trial court's order was proper, and the trial court's order was proper for two main reasons, and either reason would be more than adequate to affirm. The first is the legal action at issue, the wrongful indemnity theory, pled through our breach of contract and breach of fiduciary duty causes of action, was based on and in response to conduct, not communication. The conduct is, in fact, the general partner's withdrawal of partnership funds, and the mechanism by which that happens, whether it's checks or whether it's a wire transfer or who talks to who, that's immaterial, and that's not in our pleadings. The mechanism. It's the fact that the general partner exerted control over partnership funds, and he's the only one that's got that control under the partnership agreement, and caused the withdrawal of those funds for the use and benefit of the general partner's legal defense costs in this case, under circumstances where, by virtue of our pleadings, a majority in interest of the limited partners have made it abundantly clear you, general partner, did not act in good faith. We allege you defrauded us into this investment, and you don't get, therefore, to indemnify yourself for the consequences of your own alleged fraud. Okay, action. Conduct, not communication. The second alternative ground upon which this court could properly affirm the trial court's order is the secondary holding in this court's decision in Beving v. Beatles and subsequent decisions. And that is, even if this court assumes that the legal action in question is in part based on or in response to a communication, the July 7th email has been raised as the principal communication, and we deny that it is based on or in response to that communication. It is based on in response, again, to the act. But even assuming this court determines that there is a mixture of communication and conduct involved, well, then this court's precedent provides the rule of decision. In the Beving case, in the later case, SSC management citing Beving, and other courts around the state have, but this court has taken a lead. And the rule of decision is this. it becomes the burden of the TCPA movement to parse out, to show the trial court, which part of that legal action is based on or in response to the protected speech or petition rights and which is not, because the law is a trial court can only properly dismiss a legal action to the extent it is based on or in response to speech or petition, not if it includes non-protected speech or non-protected conduct.
How is your pleading susceptible to being parsed out?
In this particular case, I don't think it can be parsed out. And the reason is because the communication that's being alleged simply confirms, the July 7th email, the primary communication, simply confirms, frankly, what the plaintiffs already believed had occurred, but it confirms that conduct has occurred, okay? Conduct, as the Dallas Court of Appeals said in the Wells v. Crowell decision, simply because a pleading may reference a judicial action or a petition does not mean that the gravamen of the complaint is responding to that. In Wells v. Crowell, for instance, the petition was a pre-suit demand letter. And the lawsuit referenced the pre-suit demand letter and said that was wrongful, that was intended to harass the plaintiffs. And the court said, yeah, they mentioned it in the petition, but that wasn't the gravamen of the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim. It was a prior altercation in a grocery store. Here, the gravamen of the complaint, actually, the predicate facts go back years, because we wouldn't have this complaint, this wrongful indemnity theory, if we didn't believe we were defrauded, appellees were defrauded into the investment in 2017. And when you look at the declaration that's been mentioned, a holistic review of the declaration and a holistic review of the pleadings, which the law requires, in the light most favorable to the non-movement, that's what's being complained about, that the appellees believe there was wrongful conduct inducing their investments years ago. The appellees later learned of information that confirmed that. They filed their original petition believing that. They filed their first amended petition believing that. Under those circumstances, when the conduct has already occurred and the email simply confirms it's occurred, well, yes, there's an email. Yes, that's a communication. But what is the gravamen of the complaint? And that is what I believe this court's precedent and the precedent of other courts require. Another example would be there's a case out of the Houston 14th Court of Appeals cited in our brief, the Navidea Biopharmaceuticals case. In that decision, there was a single, or may have been a combination, of letters written by a legal counsel for one party to other parties. And part of the letter said, referencing a pending litigation, my client has satisfied the judgment. You parties don't get to draw down on the letter of credit that we've agreed to because we've already satisfied the judgment. But oh, by the way, if you do, we're going to sue you in the future for that. The Houston 14th Court of Appeals said, well, in that one communication, we had instances of both protected speech, that is, referencing the pending litigation and judgment and whether their client had complied or not with it, and what that court had construed as non-protected speech, the threat of future litigation, which that court had held does not constitute the right of petition, in the same email or the same letter. And so the idea that you cannot have both, perhaps, a protected communication and also a confirmation of wrongful conduct is not true. The question is the gravamen of the complaint. And the gravamen of our complaint When you look at our pleadings, and even if you look at the evidence, and you can and you should, but the pleadings are the best and all-sufficient basis for the nature of the claim, as this court and other courts have held. And when viewed in the light most favorable to the non-movement, as the standard must be, the gravamen of the complaint is about conduct. Now, in their reply brief, they try to expand the communication into multiple things. There's a request for an indemnity payment. Then there are checks that are issued. Then there's the July 7th email. Actually, none of those things are in our petition. We don't complain about any of those things. And the Ross Dress for Less case is instructive on this point. And Ross Dress for Less, Ross was suing land developer or landowner it had bought property for easement access. After paying $33 million, the seller said, "We don't have easement access. You're going to have to pay someone else for that. We're denying it." And Ross Dress for Less, in its petition, talked about all the communications denying the access. But the Houston, that was the first court of appeals in Houston, said, but the gravamen of the complaint is a failure to act. And what they're really seeking is easement access. Even though in the petition, Ross Dress for Less talked about numerous communications where the defendant had said, we're denying access, you don't have the right to access, you have to pay someone else for access. Both petition and speech rights were alleged. The Houston First Court said they're not complaining about harm from the statement. They're not trying to stop similar statements from being made in the future. That would be the related to standard. And as the court noted in 2019, related to was taken out of the statute. Now, I understand the argument. Well, we're talking about in response to. What they really want to say is if anything is asserted subsequently to a right of petition or communication, well, it's in response to. I don't believe that's the correct decision. I don't believe that's the correct standard. The cases that talk about asserted subsequently to or spawned by are frankly cases that are either pre-2019 cases or they cite back to pre-2019 cases. That is not, to the best of my knowledge, the way the Texas Supreme Court has described in response to or this court has described in response to. And frankly, if that were the test, then this court would have had to hold in Beving that the third-party claim that was filed against Beving was in response to her affidavit and deposition testimony, and yet this court held no such thing. If that were the test, this court in the Jackson v. Kell Auto Sales case would have necessarily held that the counterclaim filed by Kell Auto against Jackson was in response to her petition, and yet this court held no such thing. In both of those cases, the court held the gravamen of the complaint was about conduct, not communication. The issue of checks, they're really complaining or basing it on checks is what I heard. We had never seen the checks. The first time we saw a single check came when they filed their reply in the trial court to our response to the TCPA motion. They had no idea there was a check. Again, the mechanism by which the act occurs makes no difference to us. The general partner could have opened up a vault and taken a bag of cash for all we care. The result, the action, is what we're concerned about, not the communication. And frankly, the cases that appellants cite for this proposition that checks are communications under the TCPA, well, perhaps they can be, but not in this case. And frankly, the cases they cite don't even really hold that. The Ridge Petroleum case, for example, they cite in support of that. In the Ridge Petroleum case, it was a question of whether a royalty owner got paid what they were entitled to. And the defendant said, well, you're basing your claim on our checks and division orders, on what they said and what they didn't say. And the El Paso Court of Appeals in Ridge said, no, they're really not. It's about whether the agreement, the saltwater disposal agreement, was complied with. They're not complaining about what the checks said or didn't say. Well, in our case, we never even saw the checks. Did not even know there were checks. Didn't say anything about checks in our petition, so I don't see how we could be complaining about checks. We didn't know how the withdrawal was done. We didn't have access to those records. Only the general partner did. We were complaining about the action, and that action is not protected by the TCPA. But even if this court is inclined to believe there is some communicative content that is protected and that we did this legal action in response to, for instance, then Beving and subsequent decisions say, well, then it becomes the burden on the TCPA movement to show the trial court which part of the claim is conduct, which part of the claim is speech or petition. And if they cannot do that, and there is no legitimate way for the trial court to do that or this court to do that, then the movement has failed to carry its burden. That is the secondary holding in Beving. The movement failed to carry their burden on that issue in the trial court. Beving and that secondary holding was specifically addressed at the hearing on the TCPA motion. It was cited in my response. The case, Judge Johnson pulled up Beving while we were there in the hearing. I made the same essential argument to him then that I'm making now about Beving. And it's not just Beving, it's multiple courts of appeals all over the state have said that is the rule of decision. The question was asked, well, how do you separate the two in this case? Well, if you're going to believe that the July 7th email was somehow connected to our legal action, and I agree it was sent before we filed our legal action, but we had to amend our petition, and I cite this in the brief, we had to amend our petition to address a motion to show authority that had been filed, where we were going to have to address claims of one of the appellees that were not being asserted in our case, but were being asserted in a separate case. And at that time, as I always do when I have to amend pleadings, I went back over everything. And I said, well, you know, we actually were complaining in our original petition that the general partner had wrongfully withdrawn partnership funds and had commingled those funds, but it was vague. I concede it was vague. It was intentionally vague. We wrote that to cover a host of conduct that we contend was illegal, but it was designed to include this conduct, but I said, that's not probably clean enough. I should amend. I should make it cleaner. That's the reason I conceded timeliness here. I argued timeliness in the trial court, and I could argue timeliness here. I'm not, because I think the most straightforward and strongest argument why we should prevail and why the trial court was right is the arguments I'm making. But this issue that, well, they conceded on timeliness, therefore they concede on causation, that's not the law. That's not the test. They're two entirely different inquiries. But no, I don't concede on that. And the in response to argument, if that is the test, then every counterclaim that's filed anywhere in the state that's not otherwise exempted from the TCPA becomes a TCPA case, if they're right about in response to. If they're right about based on, well, you've got, you know, you say something about payments and checks can be communications, then I argue every breach of contract case in the state of Texas becomes a TCPA case because it's based on the contract, which is a communication. That's not what the legislature intended, certainly not after the 2019 amendments. And so those are the two primary grounds upon which this court can properly affirm the trial court's order. There is an additional ground. We've raised it. It is the fraud exemption that we believe applies. I concede it's not the clearest analysis, but this is what truly is the case. We would not have this legal action, the wrongful indemnity theory, but for the fact that there we allege fraud. Because if under our partnership agreement, they're correct, generally, the general partner would get to take indemnity from the partnership. Generally, there would be this advance of expenses allowed, and we all know that. But in this circumstance, and this is what the business organization code refers to, the indemnity standard has to be met first. And here, you have a majority in interest of the limited partners, one of the class of people who can make that determination. In fact, in this case, the only class of people who can make the determination of whether the indemnity standard has been met. They said when they filed their original petition, you, general partner, have not met it because of fraud. Therefore, that's why we filed this as a breach of contract action. That's not why this is not just a declaratory judgment action. We're saying the conduct was not just a breach, it was fraud. And that's the reason we're saying you've breached the contract, because you have not met that standard, and you don't get to go rely on the advance expenses provision that says the partnership can is permitted to advance expenses without that determination being made. Here, that determination was made. That's why that section is inapplicable. And that is the basis for our claim. And so I see my time has expired. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
Briefly, Your Honors, with respect to the fraud issue, I understand that's now being argued as the basis for why the indemnification is wrongful, but what we have in front of us are the 25 or so affidavits or declarations that tell you specifically what is going on and what is underpinning their case. And in Section 8 on CR 1075, we have almost verbatim what all of the partners are saying. They're not saying it was fraudulent. What they're saying is it was not in the best interest of the partnership. It was not being done in good faith. That is an entirely different standard than it was some sort of fraudulent behavior. And those are buzzwords that were used because the business and organization code says for permissive indemnification, if there's a determination of bad faith or not being in the best interest, then you may not be entitled to the indemnification. So this idea that, once again, we have artful pleading where it's fraud is underpinning this breach of contract withdrawal, that just belies the evidence that was presented when challenged with that situation. Nowhere in this affidavit, or at least with respect to paragraphs 8 and 9, is the word fraud even used. And then what we have after paragraph 8 is paragraph 9, and the two sentences, I believe, that sum up the entire cause of action that is being challenged read as follows. Newstream has informed all limited partners that it has used partnership funds to pay for attorney's fees and expenses of this lawsuit on behalf of the defendants to this lawsuit, and that the partnership has a need to raise additional capital in part because of those payments. So we have the communication that they're relying on as to why this suit was brought, this amended claim. Those payments, those checks, have reduced partnership funds and made it less likely that 2548 or the various other investors will receive any return of its capital contribution. That's it. That's their entire indemnification claim. We were notified of it. And those payments may reduce a return of capital. Those are statements that were in response to my email, and they're based on those payments. The idea of mixed and unmixed, right? So I've pointed out, both at the trial court level and here, those communications that are at issue. And what we have is a bunch of trial attorneys, myself included, that bring multiple facts underpinning causes of action. Defamation cause of action could be based on multiple statements. But the law is not all of your defamation goes out the window, all of your defamation claim goes out the window, because one or two statements may not be defamatory or may not be covered. What the analysis is this particular claim based on this particular fact is examined, and if it doesn't meet the standard, if you don't present clear and specific evidence, that particular claim is dismissed. Not so we're not here seeking the entire breach of contract being dismissed. We're not here seeking the entire breach of fiduciary duty being dismissed. What we're saying is your breach of contract based on payments of indemnification fees must be dismissed because you didn't reach the second step. But it's based on or in response to the right to petition, and then you must come forward with clear and specific evidence in support of the wrongfulness. Now, I know Judge Johnson found that it didn't apply in the first step, but that's the sole analysis. What are these communications, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, principally the email and the checks? Are they covered by the TCPA? And if they are, do you have clear specific evidence? And if you don't, those issues are dismissed. Because again, the struggle with the TCPA, and I appreciate it, and I understand it pretty well, and I know the court does as well, is attorneys are getting wise to the idea of, well, if I just plead it this way or I just plead it that way. But that doesn't change the fact that you still have these fundamental rights that the TCPA was enacted to protect and to guard against. So if I say, well, it's a whole bunch of stuff in this bucket that I'm suing for, and since we can't parse it out, therefore your rights go out the window, you don't have those protections, that can't be the analysis, especially when the movement comes forward and says these particular communication, these particular things are what's at issue. Opposing counsel would have you believe you can just throw it all out, but that cannot be the analysis. Otherwise, there's no protections under the TCPA for a creative attorney to come forward and plead around it.
Thank you very much. Your time has expired. Gentlemen, we appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, your case is submitted, and we will stand in recess.